I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
You lost somebody.
Sister, drowning, it wasn't anybody's fault.
You blame yourself, which you know is crazy.
Wow. You're good. Huh. That's a neat skill.
That's why you're relentless in your work. Because you're relentlessly hard on yourself. You know, you should cut yourself some slack. You'd be a lot happier.
Come on, you don't know anything about
me. You're lonely and you're sad because you locked down your emotions, which accounts for your stilted seduction technique. You're capable of great passion if you just let yourself go. But you won't. Not until you redeem yourself. Make the wrong things right. But how can you hope to do that? You can't bring your sister back. You're on your own.
Deep down inside, you're a cruel man, aren't you?
We're back again with Bruno Heller, creator-producer of The Mentalist, whose season premiere airs Sunday, September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS, right here on the TV Time Machine. Well, another indelible character on the show, of course, is the boss, Teresa Lisbon, played by Robin Tunney, as we'll hear in the following clip.
Okay. What happened with Darcy?
You're not going to ask about the case?
Is it under control?
Yes. I missed you.
I missed you, too. So, what happened?
I admitted that Red John is still alive, just like you wanted me to. And she accused me of working for him.
What?
She thinks I'm one of Red John's disciples.
The FBI thinks you're working with Red John?
Don't look so serious. It's a joke.
What did you tell her?
I told her to go ahead and prove it.
Oh, my God.
Newsflash, I don't work for Red John, so she's wasting her time.
Well, what did Darcy use as proof?
Well, nothing. How could she have any proof? I can't believe you haven't cracked Philo yet. I mean, you guys just can't manage without me, can you?
Don't try and divert me with insults.
Tell us about the relationship, rather complicated relationship, that she has with Jane.
That relationship is and is meant to be a kind of, well, Rorschach test would be wrong, but it stays in an ambivalent area because it's not necessarily important, but I like that the audience is never quite sure, as those two are never quite sure, where the relationship might go. And it's been growing in real time over the course of the 5 years of the show. And again, that's one of those things that I think is very important to a show, to reflect the genuine passing of time in the characters' lives, but also in the actors' lives. And as Simon Baker and Robin have been working together for 5 years now and have grown very close and have very good friends and have a great deal of affection for each other, that has increasingly come through. And, you know, again, that's one of those things, like in a movie or a little cable show, you can work against the natural slope of a character, the natural course of events, if you see what I mean. On a network TV show, it's important to work with where the characters are, where the actors and their relationship with each other is actually going and how they feel about each other. And so it would be foolish to build animosity between them when, in fact, what you can catch on screen in a beautiful way is two people who have a telepathy between them and have great affection for each other and are amused by each other and exasperated by each other sometimes. All of those things are real things that happen to any two people who are working together that long in that kind of intimate situation. And that's what people see on the screen. At the same time, some people think they're secretly in love with each other. Some people are horrified by that thought. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a brother and sister relationship, and it can't possibly go that way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in truth, it's like life. If they find each other in the future, it will be a wonderful, inevitable surprise to them. Or if they remain good friends and colleagues, that is also natural. It's really about letting that relationship flow, as opposed to coming up with story ideas for it. And, you know, how can we, you know, which is not to say we don't tweak it occasionally, it's very hard. I mean, from a male writer's point of view, it's very hard not to fall in love with Robin Tunney as an actress and a character. So inevitably, as time rolls on, more of that affection appears in the scripts and on the screen. But who knows where it will go? Who knows where it will go? I think, you know, speaking as the characters, they're too deeply into what they're doing and, you know, the journey they're on to be able to step back and look at their relationship. I think it would be very scary for them to do that. And, you know, they will do that in the future, but that's for the future.
But there are times when it seems like, in terms of their personal relationship, you kind of push it to the line, but don't quite go over in terms of whatever affection they might show for each other. Just little subtle things.
Yeah. But the little subtle things, you know, is precise. You know, there's a moment in the last episode of last season, he says, "I love you" to her. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I say, "I love you" to all sorts of unlikely people, you know, grips on the set. I'd hate for them to think that I really did harbor deep sexual feelings for them. But at the same time, if you're involved in that kind of, you know, intimate and emotional relationship, when someone says that, naturally Lisbon is thinking, "What did he really mean that?"
Right.
But both of them, you know, as characters, they're both in many ways emotionally shut down. It's very clear why Jane is shut down. Lisbon has her own demons and her own problems, and you know, that's why she's a policewoman and why she buries herself in her work. And, you know, she's not always out there dating every week. She's someone who, and this was always a sort of unspoken part of the initial concept of the character. He's the sort of skeptic charlatan. She's a woman of faith and commitment. There's a slight, nun-like is the wrong word, because no one would mistake Robin for a nun, but a woman of virtue and honor, who puts other people's lives and her vocation before her personal life for all kinds of personal and historical reasons, no doubt. But it's that essential, you know, she's a bit like Gene Simmons in Guys and Dolls, an embodiment of the godly religious virtues. Again, this is kind of deep back character, as opposed to something that she, you know, expresses moment by moment, but that's very much the balance of those two characters.
Now, one of the most memorable episodes of the series was your third season story finale, Strawberries and Cream.
You know who I am.
Tell me anyhow.
I have many names. Some people call me Red John.
I don't know that you really are Red John.
Fair enough. Your wife is very clean. She smelled like coal tar soap and lavender. Your daughter smelled like sweat. Strawberries and cream. I expect it was some kind of kid's shampoo.
What was the genesis of that story?
Well, frankly, the genesis of that story is we're about midway through the whole arc of the show. If we ran seven seasons, or knocking on wood, we went that long, it's kind of the end of the first act. And it was very important to bring the story back to Red John, which we always try and do for those climactic episodes, and bring it back in a spectacular way that nevertheless did not, you know, we could not harpoon the whale in the end of season three, because then we're eating whale meat for the rest for four seasons, and blubber ain't that delicious, really. So frankly, yes, I'm confessing to it's not a sin, but it's, you know, giving the audience what they want whilst denying them the last bite of pie.
Right.
So, you know, then it becomes a kind of a technical challenge. How to, you know, as a writer, I desperately want to be able to write that scene of Jane sitting opposite Red John, but can't do that without getting into all kinds of elaborate story shenanigans that I don't want to go to. So that was the genesis of the idea. And it's also part of, as we learn more and more about Red John, you know, what that story told us is how diabolically clever he is and how much power he has and how many people have fallen under his spell, which means that as the story rolls on, you never know who might be, you know, on the wrong side. You never know who Red John might be. It keeps the tension of that character who you can never see. It keeps him present and it keeps the suspense of that situation rolling. And it also gave us the chance to, you know, work with a brilliant actor in a bravura role. I'm speaking of Bradley Whitford. You know, and it, again, because you can't go to Red John, it's wonderful to be able to write a character who's at least pretending to be Red John, because, you know, villains are always fun to write.
And that was great casting, because you could imagine that he could be Red John because he was almost nondescript.
Yeah. And you know, he has a kind of, he has great intelligence, but it's not, you know, it's not overpowering or kind of menacing. He just seems like a regular guy who could slip under the radar, but still with enough power and juice in him that when he turns it on, you go, oh yeah, that guy, you know, he's got a real dark side to him. And he's also, like Baker, he's someone who, you know, comes alive in the moment and in improv and just sparking off other actors. So it was very much designed as something to not just give the audience a little jazz, but to give Baker someone great to play off in that role.
Bruno, The Mentalist premieres Sunday night, September 30th at 10 p.m. on CBS. Mm. What can the audience expect, without giving away too much, what can the audience expect from this new season?
This season, you know, speaking of that sort of longer arc and the frame of the whole show, now we're moving into the final act of the show, and we are going to fight over the course of this season in quite rapid order. We will learn a great deal more about Red John. We will get several steps closer to him. So by the end of this season, the audience is, not to backtrack here, but like I say, up to now, it's been, in terms of the Red John story, not preamble, but, you know, we've been hunting for the whale in a vast ocean. We know we have a much smaller ocean to cover. We know where he is. We know much more about him. I'm being a little incoherent here because I'm trying to explain without giving anything away.
Right.
But those people who have followed the Red John story as opposed to, you know, the standalone mysteries every week are going to be very happy and pleased with this season, because truths will be revealed. Shocking and suspenseful truths will be revealed.
Bruno, as you reflect upon the remarkable success of The Mentalist and your career to this point, what are your thoughts?
I am amazed by the overwhelming power of luck in anyone's life. It's a great blessing, but very much something that happened by chance. And I take it as that, as something everyone who works on the show is very grateful and happy that it's a success. And like I say, yeah, in this business in particular, you can spend a lifetime doing great work and never get the chance to, you know, do 100 episodes of a show. So I'm extremely grateful to Warner Brothers and Peter Roth for giving me the chance. And I'm extremely grateful to Simon Baker for making it come to life. And I'm extremely grateful for the audiences for sticking with the show and, you know, seeming to like it.
Bruno, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
I'd love to. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is Jim Benson. Join us again next time as our magical transport takes us on yet another journey exploring television's past, present, and future. You'll find your next adventure right here
on the TV Time Machine.